Welcome to Last Orders, the Spike podcast all about freedom and the nanny state. In this episode, we discuss the cancellation of Jerry Sadowitz, the perilous state of pubs, and the moral crusade against gambling. Plus, we answer your questions in our postbag section. Hello and welcome back to Last Orders. My name's Tom Slater. I'm joined, as I am every month, by the IEA's Chris Snowden. How are you doing, Chris?
I'm all right. Very well, thanks. How are you?
Not too bad, thank you, Chris.
Pleased to hear it.
We're delighted to be joined by returning guests of the show, also first time actually in the room. It was last year, but still in the kind of Zoom days. Leo Kirst, GB News regular stand-up comedian. Thanks much for coming back on the show, Leo.
Hi, thanks for having us. It's good to be able to see the whites of your eyes.
As we were saying last time.
I'm relieved that Chris isn't wearing his vest this time.
It was very hot that
day. Very hot, but you were very underdressed in a way that was actually quite, you know. I'm saying, I was thinking of like fine.
At least I put a vest on.
You did.
It was vest.
It wasn't like that at the beginning of the podcast.
Vest, bikini top.
Very revealing, but luckily he's fully clothed.
Very 2022s.
Nice. So, Leo, as we've got you on, we can't not start with Jerry Sadowitz.
Oh, yeah.
And the Fringe. Huge free speech controversy. Just over a week ago, I guess it was now, that we found out that his two-night run at the Edinburgh Fringe at the Pleasance, one of the big venues there, the second one had been cancelled after allegedly complaints from, sometimes you hear it's staff, sometimes you hear it's members of the public. Jerry Sadowitz, of course, is a infamously offensive comedian, but also still very celebrated, even amongst a lot of the sort of right on fringe set. Do you want to tell us a little bit more about what happened there and why you think this one's quite significant?
So Jerry Sadowitz was due to do two nights at the Pleasance, and which is one of the big sort of fringe hubs, one of the venues that sort of controls the fringe. And obviously Jerry Sadowitz has been going for like 35 years now. So nobody can be booking Jerry Sadowitz unaware what he's going to do. Every show he gets his dick out. And he is a torrent of just like vile, invective, racist, homophobic, misogynist, all the good stuff, you know, all the fun. But it's not in a hateful way, because obviously if it was genuinely hateful, people wouldn't like it. People wouldn't go along and watch. It's a comedy show. It's hilarious. He's celebrated by, you know, people on the sort of very sort of woke left, like Stuart Lee. Stuart Lee, loves, all he's been noticeably quiet about Jerry Sadowitz this time around, as far as I know. So, you know, previously we've seen comedians like Jim Davison and Roy Chubby Brown getting cancelled. And I think that's terrible as well. But this time, the woke left have sort of come for somebody on their side, which I think, you know, sets a ridiculous precedent. And the real problem wasn't audience walkouts, apparently, because, you know, venues, a lot of people get walkouts, get complaints and stuff. It was venue staff complaining. So you got all these, you know, blue-haired students getting a summer job punching tickets at the Pleasance. And you're seeing this across a lot of creative industries, like the people who, faced down J.K. Rowling's publishers, the executives, you know, faced them, all the staff, you know, saying, oh, we can't have this. And Netflix, same thing happened. The staff, you know, protests and stuff. It's like, Jesus Christ, you punch tickets, you'd sell ice cream. What on earth gives you the right to editorialize and, you know, curate what goes on stage? It's, you know, you're not, you know, get back in your box, enjoy your £7.50 an hour, you worm, you pathetic worm. But the Pleasance crumbled, and they said, you know, they said they couldn't have it. They've since the first statement, and the first statement was very interesting, because they said, you know, at the Pleasance, we don't censor comedians, we don't censor speech. But in this case, we've cancelled Jerry Sadowitz because there's no place for his comments. It's like, well, then you're explicitly censoring speech and you're explicitly censoring a comedian.
I think they said it has no place at the festival.
Yeah, even, no like, place
really
at all.
Condemnatory.
Yeah. Like, we've got to completely expunge this from the creative world, from, you know, from the arts. And it's ridiculous. It's dangerous because, I mean, like, I was arguing with a woman on the news about it, and she was saying, no, but he's saying these things, and, he genuinely means them because he's using his real name. Mm. And it's like, that's not how comedy works. Comedy is a performance. It's like, you know, it's like if you go, when she goes to see a magic show, does she phone the police because the magician's cutting his assistant in half? You know what I mean? It's that level of idiocy that we're dealing with.
Sadowitz also a very good magician, I should say.
One of the top 10 magicians in the world, apparently. Probably more renowned for his magic than his, than his comedy. He writes a lot of, or creates a lot of tricks for other people. He was instrumental in breaking Darren Brown through to the mainstream. Incredible sleight of hand magician. And his show shows combine sleight of hand magic with you know, vile, hilarious racism.
Hell of a combination.
The thing is, like, if you look at what he says, the sort of the words that he says written down in the page, you'd be like, well, there's no way anybody could say this and it could be acceptable. But it's a sort of testament to his brilliance as a comedian that he says all that stuff and it's hilarious. It's because he's such a repulsive, sort of wretched, pitiable figure when he's on stage that anywhere he punches is up. And it's just, you know, the hilarity of seeing this man just punching at everyone, taking everyone down. And if anything, he's toned it down a little bit from, because I've been going to see him for probably about 30 years now. Like, my mom took us to see him when we were teenagers. Mm-hmm. And he's an absolutely phenomenal comedian. It's sad that, man, the Fringe is full of complete dog shit comedians. Like, all these, you know, people who go with a message, because it's all the sort of middle class, not that I'm having to go at middle class people, I'm middle class myself, but, you know, the people who would have previously gone into journalism or something like that, you know, because they've got something to say and they want to make the world a better place. Now they're going into comedy, fucking ruining it.
Chris, were you surprised by this when you heard about it? Or is it just, I mean, it does feel like comedy is lost to this guff.
It didn't surprise me that much, no, because, I mean, how many times last 6 months have we been talking about comedians on air getting cancelled or being controversial, what have you, whether it's Dave Chappelle, Ricky, all the Netflix ones, really, Ricky Gervais, Jimmy Carr, and so on. And when we've discussed these, you know, someone's always made the point that, you know, this is satirical, you know, there's a deeper point there and what have you. With Jerry Sadowitz, who is a better comedian than any of them, in my opinion. It's been over 10 years since I saw him. I've now got tickets to see him in Brighton. Mm-hmm. This reminded me I needed to go see him again. if he doesn't get cancelled in Brighton, which is quite possible, I would have thought. You can't really make that argument with Jerry Sadowitz because it's not really satirical. It's not. It's very difficult to describe his act, really. And when you say Leah, written down, it would just be like, what?
Very Nuremberg.
It's obviously not genuine, but nor is it really ironic or satirical.
And he's not trying to make some grand point about the reason you offend is to break down taboos.
No,
it's none
he just
of that.
Does it.
Give invent to the worst.
And he just, and yeah, you
know,
exactly.
In a funny way.
Right. And when we've been discussing these other cases, Gervais and Jimmy Carr and so on, I've always said, it doesn't matter whether they're trying to make a point or if it's satirical or if there's a deeper level to it. People should have the right to go on and say whatever they want. And Jerry Sadowitz is a very interesting example of this because you can see how a lot of people wouldn't get it, right? Yeah. Especially like written down in the Sun. You know, I read what he said in the Sun. I was like, wow, that is quite near the because it's basically said he blamed the state on the economy on women and blacks and then got his penis out. I go, okay, I can see how people might, you know, take that the wrong way. But yeah, you have to be there. You really do have to be there to watch it to see what's going on. And it's kind of indescribable. And it doesn't surprise me at all that he of all people would get cancelled, even though he's got this incredible track record and he's respected by nearly everybody in comedy. Mm-hmm. But I would say what I've said before, you should be allowed to be as offensive as you want.
No, completely. And it did feel like the fact that they finally came for him was different because he was almost kind of given a free pass in the way that you're describing, Leo, very fated by some of the most right-on comedians going. But there was still an appreciation because he was that good that in this situation they'll stick up for context. And also he'd made so many efforts to not be drawn into controversy insofar as, you know, even issuing like public statements saying, reviewers, do not quote my material because you're going to make a rod for my back. Anything that pops up on YouTube, he gets it taken down almost instantly. And yet, inevitably, it still happened. Do you think you've kind of already made this point, but nevertheless, is there any kind of way back from this for British comedy? Has it become, because he always played quite a useful function, which was, even though he was kind of came around the time that kind of alternative comedy stuff just blew apart all of its kind of middle class pieties, very much against all of that stuff. If there's no room for him, is it just dominated by the Radio 4 set now? Is that just it, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, well, the great thing is, even though woke culture is sort of creeping in and, you know, and stifling so much in the arts, because it's not just, I mean, the ones that we hear about are Ricky Gervais, Dave Chappelle, and Jerry Sadowitz. You know, there's a lot that happens lower down as well, like Elaine Miller. Was warned, so she's doing a show at the Fringe. She's a lecturer in female biology, and she does a comedy show. She won the Perth Fringe Award in Australia a couple of years back, and she talks about the vagina stuff. But she was warned that her show was transphobic. She was warned by a venue, somebody running the venue, and she's warned by other people. So, you know, it stifles, you know, people see what happens there, happens to the big names, and it stifles what they do. They worry about, you know, what they're doing, if they're going to lose their, you know, the money they've invested and the time they've invested in developing a fringe show. And then you get the lower down people who don't get any attention as well. So the whole thing, yeah, the whole thing is sort of making comedy worse. But the great thing is, at the same time as that's going on, we've got the internet, which, although obviously big tech is very woke and very sort of regulated and opaque as well, you don't understand why things are shadow banned or delisted or whatever, or accounts are banned, and it's very capricious. It does let people connect directly with their audience. So I could do videos on YouTube and I've got, you know, thousands of people ready to, you know, to watch it, which I wouldn't get if I was having to go, you know, tugging my cap and, you know, asking some Ponce who runs a venue in North London if I could put on a show, you know. So it removes the gatekeepers. And I think that could be what saves comedy. Just the fact that, man, nobody really wants to see, nobody wants to be preached at or lectured, unless it's a funny lecture, you know, like nobody wants to just, they want funny. And the thing about Jerry Sadowitz was it was pure funny. It was funny first, and then, you know, he didn't really worry about anything else. And the fact that it was so purely funny, I think, has always been the excuse for it. What the Pleasants did in a follow-up statement was they said under the hate crime bill in Scotland, they could be liable to prosecution, which is true.
Yeah.
And it's what I warned about when the hate crime bill came out. And in fact, I gave Jerry Sadowitz and Frankie Boyle as specific examples of comedians who could be banned. And loads of people in comedy said, oh, do you really think they're going to ban comedy? It's like, well, here we are. They are, you know what I mean? And it's not even, you know, it's not like stormtroopers need to actually turn up on your doorstep, although they do in a lot of cases. We've seen, you know, we've seen police actually turn up and arrest people over tweets or whatever. It's just, you know, the idea that they could be prosecuted is another sort of lever pushing people in one direction.
No, and you're completely right. So a lot of the people who end up getting a visit from the police, they are kind of amateur comedians in one way, shape, or form. They're just telling often quite crap, offensive jokes to people that they know, and then the authorities show up. But maybe there is some hope on the horizon. I mean, you know, Mock the Week's gone. I'm trying to
cancel.
That's been cancelled largely, and people say, "Oh, it's no platform." It's not no platform. It's no interest. People don't want to watch this shit anymore. That's a positive development. So maybe, just maybe, things will turn around. Another much loved British institution that is kind of screwed, Chris, is the British pub. There's been a kind of flurry of interest in this particular story about a pub in Islington, the Compton Arms, because it's being faced by a license review after like four neighbours complained about it. It's kind of grabbed a couple of headlines because it was used to be frequented by George Orwell. Allegedly, it was the inspiration for his 1946 essay, The Moon Underwater, which is his kind of idealised, fictionalised idea of a perfect pub. And so it's kind of generated a lot of interest. And basically how kind of whingers are ruining everything. Like, you see these stories are sort of 10 a penny now of someone moves into an area that has a music venue next to it and they demand it be shut down at the closest opportunity. What did you make of this particular case? And, you know, is this something that is going to kind of add to the grim picture for pubs, I guess, after the pandemic and everything else?
Well, first off, I'm a bit doubtful about this claim it was the inspiration for The Moon Underwater, because Orwell makes it very clear at the end of the essay, it's almost the twist in the article, is that there's no such pub and it's not based on anything. And he's never been to a pub that is as good as his
Maybe
version.
It's lying.
Huh?
Maybe he's lying.
Possibly, I suppose.
But it's on the Compton Arms website, so I believe that it's true. You know, why would they lie about something like that?
What do they say? The inspiration for the
moon? They claim that, yeah.
Well,
I think at the end of the essay, he says something like there's one in particular. But
he said there's a few that like have some of the elements, but none of them have all the elements.
Yeah, anyway, kick them while they're down. Yeah, that's what.
I mean, are they down? It's just some idiots complained about it, isn't it? It's not like they're going to be shut down. I mean, yeah, you're right. There are people. I guess it's sort of a problem of gentrification, if you like, which I'm broadly in favour of, to be fair. But one of the problems is you get people move into a flat above a pub and then complain about the noise.
Mm.
It's like, well, come on. You know, I mean, there's an element of buyer beware about this.
I think there was one in 2014 in Brighton where someone moved above a music venue.
Yeah.
In the flat above.
Rings a bell.
The Blind Tiger or something like this. And then complained about the noise and got it shut down.
Yeah.
Which is incredible.
Well, it's incredible. Yeah. I mean, it's really incredible if anybody actually does shut these things down as a result of these stupid complaints. You know, just don't move into the city centre in general. It's a bit different if you've got a house and someone builds a pub next to it, obviously. Yeah. Then there's questions to be asked. But that's not happening because no one's building any pubs. They're all closing down.
Mm.
Pub numbers have just gone below 40,000 for the first time since records began. It's a real drop-off. I think it was about 60,000 before the smoking ban. So they're in real trouble, and they're going to be in such trouble this winter. It's unbelievable. You know, I mean, everybody is. The economy is just screwed beyond belief. I actually think it might be worse than the 70s now, the next year or two, because everyone's talking about domestic energy prices, mm-hmm. and they're bad enough. And I dare say by the time Christmas comes around, the government will be somehow paying for everybody's domestic electricity and gas use. But they can't. I mean, it's literally inconceivable that the government could even attempt that with businesses. And you've got businesses who have energy bills, let's say 20 grand, wouldn't be unusual for a pub, 20 grand a year, going up to 80 grand. I mean, now what are they going to do?
Yeah.
What are you going to put your pints up to £12 or something? In which case, no one's going to go in. I mean, are people going to be going out anyway very much with inflation being what it is, with the price of petrol, with the heating, with the food and everything being what it is? I mean, I think a huge recession is nailed on. And pubs, which in the past, actually, you look kind of in the longer term, pubs have been fairly recession-proof. I can't see it being recession-proof in this one because, as with pretty much every other business, the electricity and gas costs are going to be so unaffordable. I do not know what's going to happen. It's going to be absolutely dreadful. The booze industry, the pub trade, obviously very concerned about it. I think 70% of publicans say that they may well go out of business over the course of the next 6 months. So, yeah, I mean, pubs have had a terrible time for so long for so many different reasons. Mm. And they're not by any means the only businesses that are going to really feel the pinch this winter. But they're in a huge amount of trouble, and they certainly don't need morons complaining about noise coming out of them.
It's crazy. I mean, I was looking into some of these other noise nuisance examples, and it is incredible. So, you get a load of ones which are kind of like, there's been some like family-run pub in St. Albans was one, which had been doing live music forever, and then suddenly they decide that someone makes a complaint and then it gets upheld and then they have to put in all these crazy restrictions. There was one where it was in Hampshire where they were having a pub charity event and people preemptively complained about the live music and then got it shut down. All of these in the last couple of months. My favourite, though, was the headline was brilliant. It was Neighbours Blast South London Old People's Home as Noisy Wakes Keep Them Up at Night, which was essentially, it wasn't quite an old people's home. It was like a little old people's recreation centre, which apparently was open every night till about 11 p.m. and they would have wakes there and they would get drunk.
Oh, right.
And it was so apocalyptically upsetting to all of the people in Peckham that they complained about it. But Leo, before we started this, you said you had some actual personal experience of these kind of licensing.
Yeah, I was licensing analyst for Westminster Council, which is the biggest, I think the biggest sort of nightlife licensor in the country. Mm-hmm. With exactly what you said, people would move into Soho and then get straight in the phone at the council being like, oh my God, this is, and obviously, you know, if somebody can afford like a £2 million pound flat in Soho or a house in Soho, they've got political influence and power. So they quite often have some leverage. You know, it was ridiculous to see. Because, I mean, the nightlife economy has been battered. It was battered then. Now it'll be absolutely reeling. And, you know, for ages, I mean, luckily I work with GB News now. But for ages, performing live comedy was my only income. And so when venues get shut down because somebody says there's noise from live music, that's affecting people's livelihoods. Mm-hmm. It's not just, you know, the sort of cultural impact and the fact that people can't go out and have fun and see their friends. It's also, you know, that's somebody can't feed their family because, you know, they've lost that gig's been pulled out of their diary.
Mm-hmm. No, completely. Were there any kind of particularly crazy examples that you remember from back in the day? Was it just this kind of constant whinge that you get from
there's a constant whinge
low level?
There's also a lot of whinging about drug markets and stuff like that, because I mean, if you move to like there's Meard Street in Soho where there are open drug markets, there's so much crack being sold there that we had footage of a guy going along in the morning and picking up crumbs of crack that had been dropped and getting enough for a pipe. And there was street clipping as well, which is women pretend to be prostitutes. Although, I mean, to be fair, the only qualification you need to be a prostitute is to pretend to be a prostitute. But they take money off drunk men and pretend to put it through a door. A letterbox and say, come back to this house, you know, in 2 hours, and there's going to be, you know, the Swedish blondes here for you or whatever. And so the guys would go away, come back, be hammering on the door drunk at like, you know, 3 in the morning, waking up the residents. That's why in Soho you get a lot of a lot of doors have got signs on them saying this is not a brothel.
Really?
So it's to put off the street clippers. But yeah, nightlife was a big thing. And yeah, I mean, it's a difficult thing to make money in anyway. And like you say, with the energy crisis, I think we're coming into really, like, this winter is going to be a really tough time. And obviously the government is just sleepwalking into it because nobody's running the government at the moment. Boris is on holiday. He didn't care anyway. Like, the idea that Boris, like, I can't believe, like, for conservative government, like, what are they being conservative about? Like, Boris was only looking out for himself and, you know, his future on, you know, dancing on ice or whatever. He had no interest in, you know, sort of doing the best by the country. But nobody's running the government right now. They've had this 8-week process where, you know, they've just been picking holes in each other. And so right from the start, in 2014, when Russia invaded Ukraine, we should have been like, right, we need to not, you know, Europe should have been, right, we need to not be dependent on Russia for energy. We need to, like, let's drill in the North Sea. Let's develop the Cambo oil field. Let's frack, you know, all this stuff. Let's build nuclear power stations. If we built, all right, we've got a couple coming online, but they're taking ages. Like, if we, you know, we knew this was coming, but we didn't. We thought, oh no, this despot in Russia will just continue giving us cheap gas forever. And it's an absolute nonsense. So yeah,
I think the problem is, to be fair, that there's not very much you can get online at all before the winter. You know, I mean, America's got loads of surplus gas, but they haven't got the means to get it over to us.
Yeah, yeah.
You
know,
and you've got these special ships.
And the Rhine's dry, so you can't even get it up to
Germany at all. You know, we've got gas in the North Sea, but, like, making new drills and, you know, so on. It takes a very long time. There's no chance, if we put our, you know, foot to the pedal, we'd get much new gas for the next 18 months, I don't think.
I mean, the short term.
So it's a problem. I don't know why Boris isn't on holiday. I mean, he has got, like, after whenever it is, 5th of September, he can go on holiday for as much as he likes.
No, exactly.
But still, I mean, what would he be doing anyway? Would he be just writing out more blank checks?
Well, he's approved Sizewell C or whatever it is.
He has done that.
Yeah, so he's managed to do that
on
his holiday, which is good. But I take your point there, especially because
your time,
especially because the original invasion of Ukraine was quite a long time ago.
Yeah,
we've had a bit of a run up.
We've had 8 years to get ready for it.
Exactly,
it's nuts. And even, you know, since January, I mean, I'm not aware of anything that's been in Scotland with the Scottish Greens, who are, you know, in the sort of coalition with the SNP. I think they still are. Patrick Harvey from the Scottish Greens said anybody who wants to work in oil and gas in Scotland is a far right extremist. That's the attitude that the technocrats running Western Europe at the moment, that's the attitude they have to the fossil fuels that we desperately need and are essential to our way of living and our economy and everything.
I mean, the risk of straying off the pod topic, although we're already there, Chris, I just want to ask you, given the fact that, you know, Liz Truss is a dead cert now to be the Tory leader and the PM, I mean, you must be tickled pink. This is basically going to be a mass experiment in what would happen if the IA and the Adam Smith Institute ran the country. How are you thinking about this?
Well, I shouldn't think it will be. These things always disappoint us. I wouldn't want it. Would you want to be Prime Minister now? I'd wait a few years, personally, even if it was my, like, burning ambition. The country is going to be in such an awful, it already is, but it's going to be in such an awful state. Once she's become Prime Minister, she's going to get the blame for everything. She should be blamed for us going into recession when we do, because she should have given more free money to people. It's an impossible situation to be in. And the rhetoric and talk and chat over the next few months is going to be appalling. I was on TV with, you know, Grace Blakely over the weekend, and she just flat out denied that there were high gas prices because of the shortage of gas, because Putin was turning off the gas. She just said companies profiteering. And if we just tax them, then we'll have enough money for everyone to buy lots of it. I mean, yeah.
And she's usually so solid on these questions.
Yes, she's normally so sensible.
Yeah.
But, you know, this is going to be the narrative. The whole thing is, it's the government's fault. If people are cold, which it will be this winter, it's the government's fault. It's the government's fault. People can't accept anymore that shit happens and that we've got very high gas prices because Putin is using the gas effectively as a weapon of war.
Yeah.
And sometimes there's not really anything you can do about it.
And in fact, price caps and subsidies can sort of be counter-effective because the prices are high because there's a limited supply. I mean, this is like basic sort of market.
Really simple stuff.
And so if you put subsidies on it, then people aren't going to restrict their usage.
Right.
So there's still, I mean, you've still got the same amount of gas, but all it's going to do is push the price up even higher.
This is a problem with what Macron's doing in France. Of course, Blakely loves this. She thinks it's great because they're limiting price rises for domestic energy. or probably all energy, I think, to 4%, which, as you say, means there's no incentive for anyone to cut down their usage. The EU has a target of everyone cutting down their usage by 15%, which still won't really be enough. But no one in France is going to bother doing that.
Yeah.
The reality is you need to have price pressure. You need to have prices go up, partly because higher prices will inspire more people to pump gas and sell it to us, and partly because it encourages people to use less of it. But if you say this, or if you produce some, you know, suggestions of what you might do, maybe turn the thermostat down a bit. Maybe you don't need to have the thermostat at 22 degrees all year round.
Yeah.
Maybe have the radiators on for a little bit less. Maybe use your tumble dryer a bit less, or not at all. Well, maybe use your dishwasher not at all and just wash them by hand. People go, trying to send us back to the Stone Age. This is victim blaming or whatever. It's not people's responsibility to have to do this. It's the government's. Well, it's not the government's. The government, it's an obvious point, government doesn't have any money apart from what we give it or what it borrows, which amounts to the same thing.
But at the same time, I think one of the things that is quite galling about all this, and we should move on to gambling, which is our last thing we're going to talk about, but is the fact that so much of this, as you say, there's these external shocks, but at the same time, there's what left us so exposed to them insofar as the energy policies that have been pursued for so long. And it does feel like this is almost like the culmination of so many different failed elite orthodoxies, whether it's around climate change, whether it's around the amount of money they've been printing. All of these different things have just kind of come home to roost.
And I thought this was going to be
living standards are being shredded, you know, even more so as a consequence of that. You can understand what people
and I thought that was going to be. I knew the inflation was coming even before the Ukraine war. Right, it was already 6% before the Ukraine war, so it wasn't a massive prediction. But just from the amount of money that's being printed, low interest rates, all the rest of it, there's always going to be a lot of inflation. And I thought that would be it. I remember saying at the time, the plane has crashed into the mountain. There's nothing you can do at this point. But of course, we're not. We're gonna give it one more push. We're going to give borrowing unbelievable amounts of money, probably printing money soon, I imagine, Bank of England. I wouldn't be surprised if they lower interest rates. Should have been the Turkish approach to inflation, where inflation's 100%. I reckon as soon as they think inflation rates are kind of peaking, they'll go, let's lower interest rates. We don't want to kill off the recovery. All this bullshit. We're just going to keep doing this again and again and again. And, you know, the people on the left in particular like saying that, you know, government finances aren't like household finances because you can create your own money and that you can't actually go bust. And it's true, you can't go bust. Adam Smith said there's a lot of ruin in a nation. Which means is things can get worse and worse and worse. And at every point you think things can't get any worse, the government can carry on because the government will not actually go bust. It just builds up more and more debt, more and more debt interest payments, more and more inflation until eventually something snaps and you get like Margaret Thatcher comes in and does something. That's what will happen this time. What's going to happen this time is think people will snap and we'll end up with the equivalent of Jeremy Corbyn. Right?
Yeah.
Well, you will do after, you know, 12 years of, 12, 13, 14 years of Tory government. You're not going to go, well, let's have a Tory government to fix this.
Yeah,
people are going to swing to the other side.
Although we haven't even had a Tory government. We've had basically Corbynomics just delivered by a Tory government.
Sure, but it's still been a Tory government.
Pretty much all these energy policies are Ed Miliband's as well. Gives all new meaning to that phrase, chaos with Ed Miliband, I think. It all comes from him. Climate Change Act, price cap, I think, all that sort of stuff. Anyway, we should brighten things up by talking about gambling addiction, Chris.
Yeah.
Or rather some studies into gambling addiction.
Yeah.
And Public Health England's kind of last gasp, which was basically trying to reframe gambling as if it's a public health issue. This is something that you've written for us about. This
week.
Can you tell us a bit more about it?
There's a big push. It's only lasted about 5 or 6 years, but there's been a big push to redefine gambling as a public health issue. Now, you know, I think that I don't even consider smoking or obesity public health issues, and they're not. In the classic definition, they're not infectious, they're not environmental hazards, they're private health issues. And if lots of people take part in these, you know, talk about smoking or drinking, that doesn't make it a public health issue. It's just a private issue and should be dealt with as such. Now, gambling isn't even a health issue, right? Gambling is just a behavior. It's insofar as it's linked to health at all, it's by a very tenuous and sketchy way, which is, you know, I guess if you lose a lot of money, then you might eat less or eat too much or, you know, I don't know, you might end up on the street or something. You know, there's clearly going to be health implications at some point if things get severe enough. But you can say that about nearly anything in life, right? That doesn't make it a public health issue. So the public health lobby are keen to get their grubby little paws on gambling. And I don't think it's because they really think it's a public health issue. I think it's because the public health movement is essentially a moral crusade, a middle-class reform movement, and gambling is an obvious target to go alongside drinking and gluttony and sloth and and booze. And they would like to deal with gambling in the same way they deal with smoking and food and what have you, which is basically just lots of taxes, lots of bans, and hope that these things have some effect. Now, the reason I mention this is there was a study that came out earlier this month, which blew my mind just because the methodology was so incredibly weak. I mean, the bottom line is that there isn't a huge amount of research into gambling policies. There's some research into problem gambling as a pathological disorder, but it tends to be conducted by psychologists who generally aren't that political. They're just interested in what makes people pathological gamblers. They don't tend to come out and say we should ban this or tax that because they don't think it will work, because they understand it's an individual psychological problem. All of this is complete anathema to public health, who just think that, well, the government can solve these problems by passing enough legislation. So there aren't really many policies on the table that you could in any way describe as evidence-based. Mm. So what you get in this study in Lancet Public Health, there's a handful of fairly random public health academics contacted some of their mates, essentially, 10 of their mates, none of whom worked in gambling, all of whom worked in things like tobacco and alcohol, and just said, will you draw up a list of policies that you reckon might work in dealing with gambling-related harm?
Sounds legit.
Yeah, so, yeah. And they came up with 103 policies, which is obviously a lot. Then they contacted some other mates who were supposedly gambling experts. Yep. But actually, if you actually look at their credentials, some of them just there because they have lived experience, which presumably means they're either, you know, probably service users, yeah, in other words, problem gamblers, what have you, or just generally interested. Who knows what it means? All these people were anonymous in the study anyway. And they came back and they said that 81 of the 103 policies proposed would be effective. 64 would be very effective, and only 2 would be ineffective. Hmm. Let me give you an example of some of these policies, because some of them literally don't even make sense. You can't even imagine what it would look like. All gambling products to have plain packaging. This is clearly somebody who worked in tobacco going like, well, we did that with tobacco, let's do it. What does that even look like?
A fruit machine or something. It'd be great.
What is it? Or the lottery ticket.
or a scratch card. I mean, how does it work in a casino with a roulette?
Yeah,
how do you
yeah.
plain package
a green
that?
Roulette. Isn't that just the most 2022 thing you've seen? It's like, yeah.
A gray all the colours are the same. It wouldn't work very well.
Yeah. You can have it, but you can't enjoy it.
Tax on operators rises each year above the rate of inflation. Okay, but for how long? They'll just go bust quite quickly, you would think. Ban all gambling in venues where young or vulnerable people are present. Young people, you can kind of see that. Vulnerable, what's a vulnerable person for
an
start
old,
off?
Like an old person.
How, I don't know. I would have thought, like in their context.
They're banning disabled people from gambling.
A problem gambler, but how do you spot these people? Have they got to wear a badge or something? Can we kick them out?
They're in betting shops. Yeah. So you've got to ban the people who go to betting shops from betting shops.
Problem solved.
Yeah. Yeah. Tax on wages proportionate to the risk of harm. Okay. Well, how do you know what the risk of harm is? I guess if it's a bet, the odds in a way tell you the risk of losing money, sort of, but doesn't make any sense. This is just like, this is 3 a.m., you know, party, you know, end of the night.
this is technocrats who think that politics can fix everything. Like policy can fix things. And it can just meddle and waste money.
Mm-hmm. One more. Maximum limit on customers gambling on an operator's website at once. Why? What's the point?
Yeah. So if you get in early, you get to gamble. Yeah.
No more than 10,000 people can use this website at a time.
Yeah.
You have to use another website. All right, use another website.
Incentivize people to do it like 3 a.m. or something. I don't know.
It's
like,
bizarre. How's that going to work? I mean, they're ludicrous. And there's loads more of these, 103, as I say. And apparently the vast majority are going to be effective. Mm. This is the absolute opposite of evidence-based policy, isn't it? This is just a bunch of people who don't know what they're talking about, not even qualified to talk about it, coming up with harebrained schemes and then producing a study. They call it a Delphi study, by the way, so they don't have to just call it what it is, which is just having it's an online survey. It wasn't even like face-to-face focus group. 35 people given an online survey, 100-odd wacky ideas, and they came back and said most of them work. Despite the fact that by the author's own admission, there is no evidence for any of them. And then at the end of it, they say, this is the blueprint for what the government should be doing. It's amazing. Unbelievable.
What do you make of all this, Leo?
Yeah, it's like, I mean, like I said, technocrats gonna technocrat. So, yeah, like people think, I mean, I worked in government. I worked as a consultant for national security and policy. I worked at the Foreign Office, worked in local authorities as well. And yeah, governments always think at all levels, they think they can affect positive change on society, when really the best and most effective change they can have in society is to not get involved, to just step back and stop wasting people's money. Because what gambling shops, and I worked in Haringey for Haringey Council, obviously, you know, very deprived area, lots of gambling shops. We did have problems with people going and blowing the family money on gambling instead of buying food for the kids or whatever. They knew there's a safety net there to pick them up. But what the shops were selling was hope. So you need to make the world a less sort of hopeless place. And you do that by not taxing people as much and by, you know, providing, you know, instead of undercutting wages by constantly importing, you know, hundreds of thousands of people every year to do jobs. You know, if we didn't do that, the economy would rebalance itself. So working class people got paid more. That is just what would happen. Yeah, it might contribute to inflation. It might be more expensive to get a nanny or get a Deliveroo or get a conservatory built. But, you know, it arguably should be a bit more expensive for those things. So yeah, I think gambling shops, my dad's a gambler, gambling shops, they sell hope, and they, you know, for some people that's a real thrill in the one part of their week where they get where they really feel alive. So I think it's a shame to take it away from people. I think it causes some social problems, but not as much as the government does.
It does, incidentally, in this Public Health England report, it does mention, although it doesn't draw a huge attention to it, but it does mention that people who gamble do have better mental well-being.
Really?
And are happier, yeah. as long as they're not problem gamblers. If they're just
right.
And bearing in mind the problem gambling rate is 0.2%.
I was going to ask.
Right.
So say the overwhelming.
Because you would of all gamblers?
Of all gamblers, yeah.
Right.
I was going to ask you about that. We should probably get on to our postbag section, Chris.
Postbag, yes, it's bulging
with its own jingle.
Dip your hand in.
Postbag.
It's bulging, eh?
We've got a few good ones this time around. One of which is I'm going to kick off with because it's quite topical. What emergency items have you stocked up with in case the electricity goes off? And have you checked with your local pub if they have a generator and working log fires? It's a very specific question, Leo. But you can hang whatever you want to say off of that, I guess.
Yeah, no, I'm not worried about it. If the electricity goes off, I mean, I'll eat all the food in the freezer. But I'm not worried. I mean, I live in Richmond, so I can probably just go down to Richmond Park and build a fire out of sticks and eat all the food that's melted from the freezer. But I mean, we're in Britain. This is what people don't realise. Some reason they think we're in Gdansk or something. We're in Britain. Just put a jumper on. It's going to get, 5 degrees above zero? Oh, my God. You know what I mean? Man up.
I've been chopping bits of wood up. My neighbour had a tree fall down during a storm Eunice earlier this year, so I chopped it up for him on the basis I get 50% of his wood. So I'm prepared for that. I'm going to buy loads of smokeless fuel. Unfortunately, Gove's banned actual coal being delivered to your house now, but you can still get the smokeless stuff. And genuinely, going back to my tips on how to get through this, seems to me that coal is, or whatever, you know, probably not kiln-dried logs, which is another rip-off that Gove's is put on this, but coal is probably pound for pound a better buy than gas this winter. So if you've got an open fire, get using it. Even if you've never used it before and sit around it in the evening, you will be cold when you get to bed because the rest of the house won't be heated, but you'll be all right. Just do what Leo says, put a jumper on.
Yeah, and you can get things that you heat up on the fire and then you can put in the bed.
Yeah, can, yeah. One of those old... Yeah.
Sort of like that frying pan looking. Yeah. Yeah, all of this is going to make
what
a
came
comeback.
Before hot water bottles, yeah.
Yeah.
Might be one or two house fires. Yeah.
Let's finish with Andy Mayer from the IEA, who's asked, what would you like to windfall tax the most? And I suppose as a proviso on this, Chris, presumably you don't want to windfall tax anything, but if you had to windfall tax something, some company that's doing quite well at the moment, just out of pure spite.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's a few, isn't there? Apple, I think their computers have been rubbish ever since Steve Jobs died. I don't know if that's a direct result of that, but they certainly have got very complacent, and my iMac is pathetic now. BrewDog, just because I don't like them, I don't like their beer. I imagine they're making quite a bit of money. Apart from that, I mean, Jamie Oliver's already gone bust, hasn't he? So, yeah, that'll do. Just those two.
What about you, Leo, in particular?
I think if we put a windfall tax on any Russian-owned property in the UK, because they won't be able to pay it because that would breach sanctions, so then we can just seize their property and then we can live in it. And even though it's going to be cold because we can't have the gas on, we can look at the nice pictures.
I think that's the perfect place to end on. Practical advice for a crisis that's developing us. Chris, Leo, thanks so much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Last Orders. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Please do take a moment to leave us a rating and a review. And if you'd like to support the show, why not become a Spiked supporter? Just go to spiked-online.com/supporters to sign up. That's spiked-online.com/supporters.